content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Demi Arsenault from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the fall 2019 issue of Lion Magazine. We'll begin with our president's message, entitled, Lions Can Fill the Gaps. Greetings, Lions. Regardless of where you live, the change of the seasons comes with certain rituals. For many of us, those rituals involve food. Whether it's the smell of your grandmother's soup or your neighbor's hot dogs off the grill, the smell of the season fills you with warm memories. But that may not be the case for those living with hunger. For many, this time of year brings fear and anxiety. Yet another cold winter to make it through with little to eat. Or one more long, hot summer without a school lunch for a hungry child. As Lions, it's our responsibility to help those who need us. No one in our communities should wonder where their next meal is coming from. But whenever possible, we should look beyond the short-term fixes. Yes, we should stock food pantries and man soup kitchens. But we should also look at the bigger picture. What is causing our neighbors to be hungry? And how can we, as Lions, help change the odds for families that are struggling? Everyone should have the opportunity to make choices that are good for their health. Everyone should have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. Everyone should be able to take a walk in a park or have a safe, reliable way to get to work. So when there is a gap, no grocery store for miles, no reliable transportation, no parks, Lions can help repair these holes in our communities. We can form the social safety nets that keep our neighbors living healthy, fulfilling lives. As you plan your holiday meals or fire up your summer grills, think of ways your community could be better serving everyone and find a way to fix it. Sincerely, Dr. Jun Yul Choi, International President of Lions Clubs International. Next, we're going to move to our Global Service Department, beginning in the USA with Lions See a Need in Virginia. In Williamsburg, Virginia, patients in need of eye care were often just that, in need. Without an eye clinic in town, they were referred to local practices, and because many of the people do not have their own transportation, the no-show rate for referrals was high. Patients had to wait several weeks to a few months for an appointment. Things changed for the better when the James City Lions Club and the Lions Charity Foundation of Southeast Virginia came forward to add an eye clinic to the Old Town Medical and Dental Center. The center was established in 1993 to address the needs of Greater Williamsburg's uninsured and medically underserved residents. Project lead Lion Don Butts originated the idea to offer vision service as well, and Charter Lion Dr. Pam Lundberg, an Old Town Medical Center volunteer who has provided care for the patients for many years, identified the equipment needed to be purchased by the Lions. The club raised more than $9,000 through their annual golf tournament so eye professionals could evaluate visual acuity and eye pressure. Lundberg also began recruiting volunteer optometrists to help her staff the clinic. James City Lions, in a club of more than 70 members, volunteer their time for administrative assistance, helping patients with paperwork and escorting them to examinations. Last year, 164 patients were examined, and 129 required lenses. Our club supports the Old Town Medical Center and Dental Center, so that was a logical place to establish an eye clinic, says Butts. The Lions' core mission is a vision, so it seemed to follow that the clinic should also be an eye clinic. On average, the center provides more than 1,350 patient visits per month in all areas combined, and 80% of their patients are without insurance. Next, from New Zealand, STEAM Team revives Lost Loco. It took the advanced engineering skills of dozens of volunteers and more than 30 years of meticulous work, but the restoration of an old steam locomotive train is now complete, thanks in big part to Lions in Renwick, New Zealand. Restoration began with a collection of steam train enthusiasts, retired engineers, and Lions. They called themselves the STEAM Team and spent long hours dedicated to the project. The origin of the steam engine's name has long been lost, but Donald, as they call the engine, was used at the Pupanga mines in Golden Bay, New Zealand, from 1901 to 1931, when it was replaced with two larger engines. Left by the side of the track to sink into the mud and deteriorate, Donald was rescued in the late 1900s, by the late 1990s, by the Lions Club of Renwick, and transported to the Blenheim Riverside Railway Society's workshop at Brayshaw Historical Park in Blenheim. Restoration involved first dismantling the engine entirely and sandblasting every piece. The broken chassis needed to be rewelded and strengthened. The boiler was beyond repair and was replaced. One of the biggest challenges was drilling new rivet holes and riveting them in a blacksmith's forge. Another huge undertaking was fitting the 64 steel boiler tubes, along with fitting new axles, wheels, smoke box, and funnel. The entire cab was mocked up in plywood and transported to a manufacturer where a new steel cab was built. The boiler was adapted to burn diesel instead of coal, and a third trailing axle was added to reduce track wear on the Blenheim Riverside Railway track where it was destined. Air brakes and lights were added for the safety of the passengers. Finally, custom-built carriages in the style of the early 1900s were made for Donald from the chassis of two discarded carriages, and the steam team built fully enclosed cars with opening doors and windows painted to match the original Donald. The project cost 62,000 New Zealand dollars, which is the equivalent of 40,000 U.S. dollars. Of that, 35,000 New Zealand dollars, or 22,000 U.S. dollars, was provided by the Lions Club of Renwick. The revived locomotive passed inspection and has been certified to carry passengers up and down the line between Blenheim and the Aviation Heritage Center at Omaka. All aboard! And next, we're going to move over to a feature article simply titled, Worthy. What Childhood Hunger Taught Me About Generosity. I was 5 years old when my mom took off with me to the coast. She said she needed a do-over. We were starting fresh with no belongings, no toys, no furniture. She said we had empty hearts so we could catch new blessings. We also had empty pockets, and she had no job. She drank our whole life away, and the booze had left us washed up on a tiny beach in a town called Rockaway, Oregon. She was hoping the ocean would catch her tears and loosen her chains. My mother loves the ocean. She is more herself when it is nearby. She believes that it sees and knows, that it moves and feels. It inspires her wonder and her fear. She revels in the uncertainty that it could become angry at any moment and take lives at its will. To my mother, the ocean is God. Don't you ever take it for granted, Chrissy, she would say to me. When you look at that ocean, remember there's always something bigger than you. Respect her. Summer had just ended, and the quaint coastal town had begun to fold up. We found a small cottage, really a motel room with a kitchenette. We never said it was our home. To us, it was just number 6. My mother paid the first month's rent, enrolled me in kindergarten a block away, and bought us a sack of potatoes and some ketchup, and we began our new life. I don't remember being excited about school. It seemed so frivolous, and I thought I should be getting a job. I could get a paper route, I told my mother one night as we walked back to number 6 from the payphone, where she'd called my dad, begging him to send the $75 child support check. He promised he'd send it as soon as possible, but I knew the potatoes were running low. My mother looked for work, but the car we'd used to get to town had broken down, and there were only 2 or 3 restaurants within walking distance of number 6. She didn't want to get a job in a bar because she was trying earnestly to stop drinking. Maybe 2 weeks passed, and still no child support check, no money at all. I sat at the kitchen table one night, watching Walter Cronkite deliver the evening news with his objectivity and journalistic integrity. He said something like, "Here is the news at this supper time. I remember this because I was so surprised by it. His words were otherwise so dry, so metered, but the mention of it being dinner time was almost friendly. I wondered if he could see us. How did he know it was time to eat? My mother was staring out the window with her back to me. I said to her, "Well, he's right. It's dinner time. Right, Mom?" I thought I was being clever in catching Cronkite's sincerity. She let out a sigh. Without turning around, she said, "Do you see that out there? Those people have let their garden grow over. The cabbages have gone to seed now. They would never know or care if I just snuck over and took one for you." The quivering in her voice scared me. She turned to me and wiped her eyes. With a look so cool, I thought she might have been mad at me. She said, "If I were a thief, I would go over there and steal those rotten cabbages for you. But I'm not a thief." Without another word, she passed me and walked out the front door of number 6. She left it open, and I followed her. She walked down 5 cottages and knocked on the door to number 1, a larger cottage where an old man and woman lived. Even though they were our neighbors, we had no idea who they were. The old lady opened the door, and I wove around my mother so I could see inside. "This is my daughter, Christine," my mother stated. "We have no food. She has had nothing to eat but potatoes for a month, and now we don't even have any of those left. I don't care about myself, but could you please give her something to eat?" The old woman was short and fat with dark skin and black hair twisting around her head. Her name was Anita Vanover. Her husband was a tall white man who was just called Van. I could see into their cottage. The table was set, and Anita and Van were obviously just sitting down to eat. The smells coming from inside made me drool. I don't remember Anita saying anything to my mother or even asking her husband first if she could give us something, but I remember her packing up her table, the pot roast, the carrots, the gravy, the potatoes. She handed it all to my mother. It turned out that the couple had friends who owned one of the restaurants where my mom had tried to get a job. Anita talked to them, and they hired her. Anita and Van became my caretakers in the evening. They saved my mother and me. At that moment, though, I don't think Anita and Van thought they were saving lives or forever changing the path of a child. I think they thought they were doing what they were supposed to do when a woman with a little girl comes to the door and says she needs to eat. What more needs to be said or done? They probably figured that it's just food. Anita gave so effortlessly and so quickly that I doubt she ever thought about it again. But that one moment taught me a lesson about giving that I have never forgotten. There came a day, 30 years later, when I passed that lesson to my own children. My daughter's school had a food drive, and she was excited to collect food for it. Even at 10 years old, she had a strong sense of community. She wanted to be either a police officer so she could help people, or an astronaut so she could protect the planet from wayward asteroids. We had to keep her from watching the news because it moved her to the point of tears. Her heart would break for the human condition. She went to our pantry and started bagging up the canned and dried goods. All the while she talked, "Oh, I'll put in the green beans. I don't like those. I'll save the Kraft macaroni and cheese. We can give them some no-name brand." And I realized my daughter, as generous and good as she already was, knew nothing about giving. I felt like I had taught her nothing. She didn't know about Anita and Van. She didn't know about number 6. She didn't know that she could see the face of a hungry child if she looked long enough at her own mother. So I told her. I told her that my kindergarten teacher thought I was retarded because I was so hungry that I didn't perform well in school and was always slower than the rest of the class. I told her that Anita could have just gone to her cupboard and made me a peanut butter sandwich, and my mother and I would have been so grateful. But she didn't. She gave the best she had. The biggest problem with poverty is the shame that comes with it. When you give the best you have to someone in need, it translates into something much deeper to the receiver. It means that they are worthy. It's not good enough for you. If it's not good enough for you, it's not good enough for those in need either. Giving the best you have does more than feed an empty belly. It feeds the soul. And this is from Katie Levine, Christine is her full name, Christine Levine. She's a comedian, actor, and author best known for performing in the sketch comedy television series Portlandia. And next I'm going to move over to our LCIF Impact Department with an article titled Kidsight Program Expands to Change Lives in Colombia. Esteban had never had his vision screened before. He had never seen those strange devices, but the lions who brought them made him feel safe. He and his schoolmates lined up for vision testing, then followed the simple instructions. Look straight ahead and find the little bunny on the front of the machine. Esteban's world was about to change. Many children are unaware they have a vision problem. With their impairment undetected, these children may struggle to develop life skills and learn in school. In addition, when certain eye conditions go untreated, they can result in permanent vision loss. This is common in many areas of Colombia where eye care is non-existent. But Lions are determined to change this reality with Lions Kidsight Colombia, a program that has succeeded in the United States called Lions Kidsight USA and is supported by Lions Clubs International Foundation, also known as LCIF. The program screens children between the ages of 6 months and 6 years, though Lions are encouraged to screen children through grade 12 when possible. Lions test for risk factors that may indicate a problem, then refer children to an eye doctor for further evaluation if needed. Now, Lions are implementing this program throughout Colombia, aiming to screen the vision of 6 million children. The Lions secured a $69,022 grant from the LCIF to purchase 10 vision screening devices. Past International Director Dr. Ed Cordes, a retired optometrist and chairperson of Lions Kidsight USA Foundation, traveled to Colombia to help with training, including visits to an elementary school and a daycare. Of 118 children screened, 20 were referred to eye doctors. Esteban was one of them. Doctors discovered Esteban had strabismus, a condition where misaligned eyes can cause double vision. Uncorrected, this can lead to amblyopia, a disorder in which an eye fails to develop proper vision and can possibly lead to permanent vision loss. Now that Esteban is receiving treatment, he can see more clearly and is no longer at risk of losing his vision. It was an excellent experience to have professionals of all different backgrounds at our school, says Immaculata Solana de Hernandez, principal of Normal Superior La Hacienda. They have good hearts and are dedicated to what they do. On behalf of our community, I give the most sincere thanks. The Lions also want to establish satellite clinics in rural areas, an enormous challenge Dr. Cordes is certain they can manage. There were Lions who were so enthused about the program that it became contagious, and others became strong supporters as well, says Dr. Cordes. Within weeks, Lions with Kidsight Colombia screened more than 16,000 children. More than 1,600 were referred for treatment, with the costs covered by the Caribbean Ophthalmologic Foundation and Colombia's National Health Service. With support from LCIF, Colombia's Lions have made a strong stand against vision impairment, and their impact will only grow. To learn how such projects receive LCIF funding and how you can contribute through Campaign 100, visit lionsclubs.org/campaign100. And again, that was lionsclubs.org/campaign100. And for our next feature article, Growing in the Dark. Well, how did you do it? He was asked. It's easy, Florid Paul Rubin said to his doubting professor. One has a sticky flower, and one has a dry flower. A horticulture student at The Ohio State University, Poruban had been assigned to distinguish between an American cranberry shrub and the European variety, two plants so similar that even his sighted colleagues couldn't see the difference. But he had done it easily, and the professor was insinuating that his blind student had cheated. He had not. Poruban, born with just 10% of his vision, had studied the plants and seen the difference. He had felt it with his fingers. Almost 60 years later, his discovery about cranberry shrubs is in the plant identification guides, and the 81-year-old accomplished plant pathologist remembers the moment in class clearly. Frustration, he says. Frustration has been a motivator. He's not talking about the frustration of facing tasks that would not be easier done with sight, but the bigger frustration of facing people like the professor who assumed that if you can't see it, well, then you just can't do it. Prejudice, discrimination, things you don't want to get angry about, but you just want to get ahead of, motivates you to move on, says Poruban. I've had this kind of motivation all my life. Floyd Poruban was 4 when his parents were told that he had just 10% of his vision. Move to the country where your son can get sunshine, exercise, and fresh air is all the doctors at Cleveland Clinic in Ohio could offer. So when Floyd was 7, his parents followed doctor's orders and moved from the steel mill and factories of Lorain, Ohio, 15 miles east to the robust agricultural area of Avon near Lake Erie. No doctor could predict what was to follow. No one would expect that in the early 1940s, when education and career opportunities for the blind were limited, if in existence at all, that little Floyd Poruban would grow to be called a pioneer. In 1957, he became the first blind person admitted to OSU's science program, and in 1961, he graduated with a degree in horticulture. He followed with a master's degree in plant pathology in 1964. In March, Poruban, a 52-year member of the Avon Lions Club, who spent nearly 40 years as site chairman, received the 2019 Distinguished Alumni Award from OSU's College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences. Today, the Porubans, Floyd and his son Rich, also an Ohio horticulture alum, specialize in the field-grown woody plants and shrubs at Poruban Nursery in Avon, Ohio. They work from the home Floyd Poruban built for himself and his wife, Anne, on land he built in 1969, land he bought in 1969, to expand the swiftly growing nursery that he started after college. He received the first horticulture and enterprise loan ever given to a blind person in the U.S. for that acreage, and it took a significant fight to get it. No one believed a blind man could repay them, he says. There's an inherent distrust for the handicapped. I ran into it in college, and I ran into it when I was building my house. Despite the doubters, Poruban has persisted, every day heeding the same advice he has passed on to his son. Get out of bed. Don't ruminate over it. Just keep moving forward and have faith. When his family first moved to Avon, the 7-year-old had to catch a bus along the road, travel 2 miles and step off, then cross a busy state road to board a second bus that took him to, quote, sight-saving class back in Lorain. I don't know, he says when asked how a blind youngster managed to cross a busy road every day. I am a person with so much gratitude. There doesn't seem to be a day when I was alone. There was always someone with a hand to help me. That's why I joined the Lions, he said. I gotta return this. When it came time for high school, Poruban chose to be mainstreamed into the Avon High School instead of going to a school for the blind. The teachers were in a flux, he remembers. I didn't know what to do with him, his teacher said. Because Poruban had been taught to type, his teacher sent him to the only place in the school where there was an unused typewriter, and that was the football coach's unused office downstairs. He certainly wouldn't be in anybody's way, and he could type a few stories. Poruban typed his stories as directed, but the coach sought to rescue the teen from his boredom and put him to work as a manager for the varsity football team. He earned a letter. Across the hall, another coach ran the industrial arts department. He watched carefully as Poruban, already skilled with his hands, surprised everyone by building a fine walnut sewing cabinet and not cutting his finger off. because Porubon graduated as one of the first school's first National Honor Society members, Rehabilitative Services in Ohio said he could go to college with the caveat that he maintain a 3.0 average to be reevaluated each quarter. He chose Ohio State. When the horticulture students who were required to climb a tree with a rope and a saddle, he did. When he was offered a job in a giant greenhouse folding baskets and shipping tomatoes, he folded 1,000 a week. When a professor repeatedly dismissed him, saying a blind person can't do credible research, Porubon proved him wrong. In the university's first plant disease clinic, he researched crown gall, a bacterial disease, and his work resulted in the discovery of plasmids, still a widely used tool in cancer research. By the time he graduated with his master's degree, Porubon had become so skilled at propagating plants that his college friends asked him to start some for their new businesses. His own business then grew so quickly that the small hobby greenhouse his father built for him in his youth was no longer enough. He met Anne, a nurse he met at a school dance, applied for a USDA loan, and together they built their house and a greenhouse. Although she was pregnant with Rich at the time, Anne had to stand in a ditch and hold the level while he built the foundation, says Porubon, who laughs with the memories. A lot of gut, a lot of determination, and a lot of success is what helped him be successful. And a little luck, his dad admits. The Porubons had a field of rhododendrons thought to be ruined by flooding, but when they began to clean up the rotted plants, they discovered that fungi had emerged in the field. Determination and time in their makeshift lab led father and son to a new discovery in their part of the U.S. It allowed them to cut back on fertilizer by 90% and switch from a heavily cultivated nursery to a more natural way of growing. Porubon, who can see only the sun when it shines on his window, says research never stops in our minds, and blindness is never an excuse. His is a story that should be told over and over, says Rich Porubon. When people say how hard life is, I say, you have no idea. And I did have to edit that story just for time, because we have come to the end of our time today. But be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Demi Arsenault for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for the print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after this broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And again, 919-832-5138. Have a wonderful day.